You're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, episode number 18.
I'm a doctor. I've lived for over 2,000 years.
I am Scottish. I can complain about things.
Shush.
Hi, I'm Don Bettinelli, and you're listening to The Secrets of Doctor Who, where we discuss the latest episodes of the hit series Doctor Who. Today we're talking about yet another two-part episode, a two-part story in this ongoing season of two-parters. We're discussing the Zygon invasion and the Zygon inversion.
You just want cruelty to beget cruelty. You're not superior to people who were cruel to you. You're just a whole bunch of new cruel people. A whole bunch of new, cruel people being cruel to some other people who'll end up being cruel to you. The only way anyone can live in peace is if they're prepared to forgive. Why don't you break the cycle?
Joining me today on the panel are Father Roderick from Amersfoort in the Netherlands. Hello, Father.
Hello.
And Jimmy Akin joining us from San Diego. Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy, Dom.
So this is jam-packed two episodes, but I really want to talk about the ending of the second part. So I'd like to kind of move through the recap so we can get to the end. But but there's a lot of good stuff, so I don't want to skip over it. So but let's dive right in. There's also I want to bring up also the question of hybrids, which is going to come up again as we talk about this. But We got to kind of start with previously on Doctor Who, mm-hmm. because you got to kind of know, remember what happened in, was it the Day of the Doctor? Was it the Time of the Doctor? I always mix those up. I think it's the Day of the Doctor with the Three Doctors, the 50th anniversary special, and the one with Missy where she kills an Osgood, mm-hmm. which I don't, now that one slips my mind too. Death in Heaven. Yes, thank you. From the end of series season 8. So in the Time of the Doctor, we have this showdown, this ultimatum, where there's the Zygons. You have Kate Lethbridge Stewart and her Zygon duplicate facing off in the Black Archive of UNIT. There's a bomb going to go off. We're counting down, and the doctors manipulate a memory device which wipes their memory, so neither one knows which one is a Zygon and which one's human, and so they both are at this blank spot where they both have to say, stop the countdown, and that's where you can start a negotiation. A peace treaty results from that. And that Osgoods, the Osgood human and Zygon Osgood, become the keepers of this peace treaty. And that's sort of where we begin this episode.
By the way...
Yeah, go ahead, Jimmy.
I just wanted to say there's... I have no idea if Stephen Moffat's aware of this or not, but in The Day of the Doctor, when they do the memory wipe so that the humans and Zygons don't know which side they're on, that's actually in order to ensure a just and fair treaty. That's actually a manifestation of an idea that's very famous in philosophy. There's an American moral and political philosopher named John Rawls, and Rawls had the idea that the way to figure out what was just was to imagine trying to set up a society or a social arrangement based on what he called the original position, where nobody had been assigned a role in society yet. And if you didn't know what role you were going to have in society, but you agreed that this way to do it was just and fair, then it would be just and fair. And so I love that application of it in a science fiction setting where you have people who literally don't know what side they're going to be on, and they have to come up with something that's just and fair for everybody. I think that's brilliant. I love that.
and we see sort of an extension of, not exactly that concept, but an extension of this idea of when you bring two sides to a table, what can result? What do we want? What do we take away from that? And so we begin with the result of that peace treaty, which is the Osgood box. Father, how did you when we started this episode? We had this opening video of the Osgoods talking about the Osgood box and mm-hmm. the nightmare scenario. When we jumped into this, what was your reaction? How did you what did you think was about this opening and this beginning?
Well, my first association with this whole thing was I had two like references. One was, this looks like an instruction video from Lost, you know, when you're on the island and you get to see these old instruction videos from whatever doctor was there in his white coat and he was explaining, well, this is the situation. So you get basically some extra information that gives you some exposition as to, well, this is the situation. This is the box. This is us. And the second thought that I immediately had was, oh, J.J. Abrams. This is the famous plot device that J.J. Abrams has famously explained time and again that he does in a lot of his television shows and movies. Like, you have this box and you don't know what's in there. You just know this is important and this might be pivotal for the story. And so the box itself becomes this promise of something good, and it makes you curious, and it makes you want to watch until the very end to know what's in that box. And I think that Moffat follows this to the letter. He's actually just, I wouldn't be surprised if this was an homage to the box of Pandora or whatever it is that J.J. Abrams always uses. So immediately I was like, okay, this is going to be the final scene, the box. It's all going to be about the box. Little did I know that there would be two boxes.
Well, like Chekhov's statement, if you show a gun in the first act, it has to be fired in the second act. And we literally have this box in the first episode, and it needs to be fired or opened or whatever in the second act. So we knew that was coming.
Yeah.
So we have this opening montage, and once upon a time there were three doctors, two Osgoods, and one peace treaty.
Yes.
And then the Osgood in an Old West setting is under being attacked by a Zygon. It's hiding from, running from, sends the doctor attacks, nightmare scenario.
Mm-hmm.
That's our open. And then we cut to the doctor in the TARDIS mm-hmm. alone.
Playing Amazing Grace.
Amazing Grace.
And we know, we've heard from before, that he, that Peter Capaldi actually plays guitar, and he's playing this on the guitar. Any significance? Do we think that Amazing Grace has a significance to this episode, or is he just playing guitar?
Well, he's old enough to be your Messiah, so Amazing Grace could be fitting for a Messiah to play. He's just playing his theme song,
So probably just something he's playing because it's fun to play Amazing Grace on the electric guitar.
I couldn't find any references to Easter eggs mm-hmm. around that. What did surprise me, however, when it comes to the Osgoods, I was a little bit confused because you get this very brief flashback of one of the Osgoods standing at the grave, at the tomb of her sister. I'm thinking, I mean, she was killed, and now there are two, and I still don't exactly know. I must have missed something, because I still don't exactly know what happened, why she is alive, and why there are two.
What they're doing there is, during the Day of the Doctor, you had all of the humans at UNIT duplicated by Zygons.
Yeah.
And so you have that scene where the two Kates are negotiating the treaty and so forth, while the two Osgoods, the Zygon and the human Osgood, watch. And so mm-hmm. apparently after that happened, the two Osgoods, the Zygon Osgood, retained the Osgood form. And so Missy in Death in Heaven killed one of the Osgoods, but we don't know which. And this video with the Osgood box is something that dates from right after, apparently, the treaty was set up, before that Osgood was killed. Incidentally, you mentioned J.J. Abrams' use of this kind of plot device. It also was used by, it's been used by a lot of people, but Alfred Hitchcock gave it a name. Uh-huh. He referred to the mysterious object that the characters care about, but the audience doesn't know what it is or isn't as invested in it, as the MacGuffin. It's the thing that drives the plot forward. Mm-hmm. And to give a Star Wars reference, which I know you two will appreciate, in the original Star Wars movie, the MacGuffin was the plans to the Death Star that R2-D2 is carrying, and that's what drives the plot forward. In Psycho, it's the money that gets stolen by... I'm blanking on her name, but by the actress at the beginning of the film. And in this, it's the Osgood box. And what I find interesting about the Osgood box, number one, it looks like the moment, the box from the Day of the Doctor, mm-hmm. that was the ultimate weapon that he would use to, you know, push a button and destroy Gallifrey and the Daleks. It looks like that same box. It's even got Time Lord gunk all over it.
Yes.
But it's called an Osgood box, and we don't know at this point why it's called an Osgood box, and so I found that very intriguing.
And I'm not sure we actually ever find a definitive answer to that.
Oh, we do.
We do.
Okay, all right. We'll get to that then, because I don't want to jump too far ahead, because I'm looking forward to hearing that. So we have this peace treaty that the Osgoods themselves are the living embodiment of it. There's this idea of through the box, and so we have this moment where the one Osgood that remains is captured by a Zygon. We go to the Doctor, and then the Doctor, in this nightmare scenario where the treaty is broken, I felt like just to kind of look at this whole thing. This very much, and I'm not being profound when I say this. This feels like a very much a statement about aliens among us, and not aliens from outer space, but people of other cultures, other countries. This is especially when you think of the context of Great Britain, where the large minority population that lives in Britain, many of them are Muslim, and so you have this frisson of. Not a frisson, that's kind of flippant, but this tension of Muslim terrorism in the background from splinters and extremists, whereas the vast majority of them are just peaceful people who want to live there. And then if you go further back in British history, you have the Irish Troubles, where you had the Irish living among them, and some of them, you know, could break out in violence. And so it's within that context that we get this story of an uprising among us from within us, that people that look like us, they live among us, and the attack can come from anywhere. And so that's sort of the tension that we're getting.
Absolutely. It's a very, perhaps one of the most political episodes of the year or pair of episodes.
All time.
It's definitely reflecting the sentiment that we have over here in Europe. Very similar problems currently in the Netherlands with the refugees arriving, and people are afraid not because they think that everybody is a terrorist, but everyone is a potential terrorist. So there's this fear of you never know who has infiltrated these people, and so. Let's just choose to be scared of everyone, because that way, you know, we're not being played and we're vigilant. But of course, it creates also a huge distance between the native people of the country and then anyone who is a stranger, who is perceived to be a stranger, even people that have lived here for, you know, who have been born here, but parents came from elsewhere. They're also kind of like treated in a different way, and it's a big sociological problem right now in our society, and it creates a lot of unrest. And I think this episode chooses to take the bull by its horns and just really confront us, just like good science fiction always does. It shows us a mirror. This is you. So what are you going to do?
One of the things that they say in the first episode is the doctor makes a comment about how the youth tend to be more radicalized than their parents.
Yes.
And that's true across cultures. You know, whenever there's an uprising of some sort, it usually involves the youth because the parents are more settled in society. They've established a place for themselves and they don't want to upset the boat, but young people have a natural restlessness, and so they're kind of playing with that here, I think, with the radicalization of the Zygon youth. Something that I found fascinating was they mentioned that You know, there are 20 million Zygons, and according to the terms of the peace treaty, they needed to be swapped out for the nearest 20 million humans who just happen to be a large portion of the United Kingdom. Well, there's only 60 million people in the United Kingdom, so that would mean one-third of the United Kingdom are now Zygons in the Doctor Who universe. And I thought, wow, if I was a British kid thinking about that, the idea of a third of everybody here is an alien, and what happened to the people they replaced? Where are they now? I mean, that would be a really creepy concept.
And I thought at first that they were insinuating that every twin, every identical twin, is actually a pair of a Zygon and a human. Thinking, wow, that's a lot of twins.
Well, I got the sense that they were somewhat spread out around the world, like some in New Mexico, some in Turkmenistan, some Central Soviet Republic, former Soviet Republic, that sort of thing. But that it would that they started in Britain. Yeah, I mean,
some colonies shot off.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. So that this idea that, but you say that, you know, every third person could be one of them, and with the fear that would result from that. So let's move right into it. The Doctor gets this message. Now he's trying to contact Clara, and he's leaving these 130 voicemail messages on her iPhone.
127 missed calls.
This is Dr. Disco. He takes several different names in this episode. Dr. Disco.
Basil.
Funkenstein.
Dr. Funkenstein, which is from a reference to a band, Parliament. This is a song. Funkenstein, Basil, and a few others. So for some reason, he in this episode he tries out these names, and it's kind of interesting.
Kind of goes name crazy. We have more Doctor Who fake names in this episode than in any other.
Yes. Yeah. But Dr. Disco, really? No wonder that Clara doesn't pick up.
I love Clara's voicemail message. I'm either on the tube or in outer space, which is probably literally true.
Yes.
So, and then he hangs out inconspicuously, creepy old man, in a playground with two little girls, who turn out to be the Zygon High Command, and they're kidnapped. Then we see.
Ooh, can I comment on that?
Yes, please.
I love the way they do that, where he's in the playground, he's kind of pursuing these little girls, he's talking to them about how we both know you're actually very blobby indeed, don't we? And the way they set it up, this would be a classic opportunity to have a joke on the Doctor where he's misidentified two totally normal human girls.
Yes, that's what I was expecting.
Alien overlords, and it's like they're setting us up for that reveal, and then, nope, they really are alien overlords.
Because they don't say anything. They're just standing there looking at him suspiciously. Yeah. And you're
it's a double reverse.
It was a lot of fun. And go ahead.
Go ahead. So we're going to say we cut to the unit headquarters, and we get this video that shows Osgood under the control of the Zygons, and the manifesto, which is there will be truth or there will be consequences.
Yeah, and it's got this typical like hostage taken by terrorists vibe with the logo behind it, and then the person, of course, being forced to send that message, and it's very clear what they're referring to here.
Father, are you being forced to have that background behind you right now?
What? No, I am totally not forced to do this podcast. I'm doing this by my free will. And I just want to say to my parents, I love them. Go right ahead. Let's continue with the show. I love Doctor Who.
There will be truth or there will be consequences. So this is their manifesto. The truth is they want the truth of who they are to be known, so they want to live as Zygons without having to take false form, or there will be consequences, which is apparently killing all the traitor Zygons, that is those who aren't on their side, and any humans that they feel like killing too, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Starting a war with humans.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. So we cut now to Clara. Clara at her apartment. She's as she's coming in, she sees a little boy crying. She goes to find, he can't find his parents. She goes to find his parents, goes into this apartment where we have these creepy people who have, you know, a very flat expression, and then we cut. And it was very interesting. I said to my wife as I'm watching this, because as I want to do, as she came out of the apartment, she was tying her hair back. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, why is she tying her hair? Like, why is she – what changed? Mm-hmm. And that was my hint that, as we know, this was the moment of the swap, the Clara duplicate, yeah. Bonnie taking over.
Yeah. There's also another indication, a visual indication that something is wrong. And it's classic. I mean, Hitchcock taught us all this stuff. It's the skewed camera. There's not one shot in that apartment that has straight lines. It's all like the camera is wobbly and it's like slanted. And you know that that's always a sign to make you feel a little bit. You usually don't realize it, but it's designed to make you feel uncomfortable about the situation. And that happens several times in this episode.
We see that again in the second episode in the dream sequence. Yeah, that starts that one. Mm-hmm. So the Clara duplicate calls the doctor back, and they join. She joins them at this school where the former high commanders, who have been, we'll find out soon, have been reduced to a pile of lint, where their headquarters is beneath the school. Kate calls the stalemate as they're going in. Kate Lethbridge-Stewart, the head of unit, mm-hmm. calls the stalemate an impossible situation, which the doctor replies, yes, I know, it's called peace. And there's this tension throughout where you just get the sense from Kate that she is just unhappy with the way things turned out at the end of the day of the doctor, mm-hmm. this peace treaty. She doesn't like it as much as almost as much as the terrorists don't like it.
Yeah, I guess I mean, and she stays consistent with this until the very end. Like her knee-jerk reaction is, well, let's solve this with, you know, violence or military action, and that seems to be the real stalemate here. These both parties think that they can resolve the situation and get to peace by using force, and the whole story is going to tell us that that's not the solution.
She's her father's daughter.
The Brigadier was very similar in outlook.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's going to be another reference to that later on.
And the Doctor had the same kind of tension with the Brigadier, where the Brigadier would want to be using force, and the Doctor would be wanting to use something else to solve a situation.
Mm-hmm.
So moving ahead, we find out that the terrorists have set up their camp, their headquarters, in this country of Termezistan, which just don't go looking it up on Wikipedia. It is a fake country.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Jimmy.
Oh, there's a little. The connection is not working. We don't have audio.
This should be better.
Go ahead.
We've got two field trips in this episode. Yep. One to Truth or Consequences, New Mexico in America, and one to Termezistan. Okay, why is America considered mature enough to have be named as a real country with a group in a situation like this, but the obvious stans from the former Soviet Union are not considered mature enough to have this kind of story set in one of them for real? I just found that really interesting that we get to name America as a real place without worrying about Americans going crazy and, I don't know, firebombing the BBC. But if you said, you know, Turkmenistan or something like that, some real place, then for some reason they can't handle that.
I don't know. Perhaps they're trying to get on the air in Eastern Europe, and they just want to play it safe. They know they've already, you know, all the eyeballs in the U.S.
Well, it kind of goes to the roots of what this episode's about, in one sense of you know, the fear of the other, mm-hmm. and the fear of legitimate violence sometimes.
By the way, I thought that the entire New Mexico story, or at least that the story about the Truth and Consequences being a real place, that was made up. And
no,
it's real.
No.
It's got a Wikipedia page. It happened. I was like, what?
They named themselves after Truth or Consequences with Bob Barker.
That's amazing.
A TV game show, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I've been by there. I forget if I've actually been through Truth or Consequences, but I've, as you may be able to tell from my decor, I've spent a lot of – I live in the desert Southwest, and I've spent a lot of time around in Arizona and New Mexico, and I know I've been by Truth or Consequences if I haven't actually been through it. Apparently they filmed there for this episode, and I was really glad when they have an establishing shot at the beginning of that sequence showing a highway sign with I-25 going through Truth or Consequences, and I thought, I really hope they looked that up, and I checked it, and it is real. It is I-25 that goes through Truth or Consequences, and apparently so they just filmed it there.
Nice.
Yeah. Excellent. It certainly was not. It was certainly not the UK. But sometimes they'll film in Spain to kind of to get that feel of a more desert like place. But I'm kind of glad they're really going for the authenticity in their location shoots.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that bothered me is why did the Doctor take a plane? Like, why didn't he take the TARDIS? Aside from the obvious need for him to be in the plane as they were coming back so that Bonnie could try to shoot him down.
Well, they kind of hang a lantern on that. He says he just wants to go poncing about.
Yes.
I guess. I mean, this is one of those things about the Doctor that kind of drives me a little crazy is the in the midst of a serious thing, you can just kind of do something completely harebrained. Like, you can be in Termezistan in 2 seconds or take a plane that will take 8, 10, 12 hours, or wherever Termezistan is. It's just my little...
Well, he's a Time Lord, so he can do anything he wants with his time. That's probably the point he wants to make. The thing that bothered me a little bit, and this seems to be a bit more of a nuisance to me than in the previous season, is that they give Capaldi's Doctor this kind of like, oh, and I'm hip, by the way. Look at my glasses. Look at me being crazy. And it doesn't feel right. It doesn't work for me. As much as I like the Matt Smith's kind of wackiness, and it seemed to fit his hairdo, and stuff. But with Capaldi, it just doesn't work with the way they established his character in the first season. What was the appeal to me of Capaldi's Doctor was his grumpiness and him being Scottish and the fighting eyebrows and that kind of stuff. And they seem to have abandoned that a little bit. He's wacky, but it feels forced and a bit contrived. Or is that just me? I don't know.
I go ahead, Jimmy.
I agree. I don't like it when the Doctor starts wallowing in his own publicity. And I didn't like it with Matt Smith either. Whenever the Doctor is in the I'm too cool for school mode, I find my enjoyment diminishes. On the other hand, I actually kind of like the way they've mellowed Peter Capaldi's character some this season. Last season, it seemed like he was stuck in permanent regeneration madness. And he's evened out a little bit more this season, and I find that more relatable.
Okay.
Well, there was a very conscious decision I read in an article, a conscious decision to make the Doctor less grumpy and more approachable. Okay. So more, he's wearing the T-shirt and the crazy checked pants instead of the more formal wear that made him, as he points out, I tried the magician look and it didn't work for me. He said that, I think, in one of the last few episodes.
Interesting.
So there has been a conscious decision to make him a little wackier.
And do you think that is because of audience feedback? Because people thought he was too grumpy? Or I was kind of, to me, it was appealing that he was a bit mysterious, a bit unapproachable. It just reminded me of the older Doctors, like the classic ones.
I think that was precisely it, though. I think it was an appeal to the audience.
Okay. Oh, well.
It's probably a good thing that they're trying to make him a little more approachable, because their ratings this season have not been quite as good. And they argue that, and Stephen Moffat's been asked about it, and he said, no, the business plan calls for at least another 5 years of this. Yeah. And their ratings, once you factor in delayed time-shifted viewing and stuff, are actually fine. But they're... night of ratings when this is first broadcast have been down. Mm-hmm. And partly that's been apparently because the BBC has moved Doctor Who out of its ordinary time slot which was a tea time time slot so the whole family could watch it. Now they've been putting it later in the evening up against one of the other most popular programs. And so they've been doing kind of ratings warfare with it. And that's
dumb.
Put a hit on the ratings. Well, Peter Capaldi and Stephen Moffat and others have criticized the BBC on that ground, but making the Doctor a little more relatable could help offset that. It's also a common thing you see in television for characters that start off very abrasive to end up becoming more likable over time. I've seen that in series after series. That was the plan, for example, with the sixth Doctor, Colin Baker. I mean, he started off attempting to strangle his assistant, and he was extremely arrogant, and the idea was we're going to make him likable over time. They didn't do it quickly enough in his case.
Right.
But in other TV shows, you see the same thing. If you've ever seen the old 70s MASH series, they would regularly introduce characters that were abrasive, like Frank Burns and Major Houlihan and some of the others. And then after a few seasons, they would become more and more likable. And I think that's just a natural trajectory. I think it's also something that actors push for. They don't want to be too unlikable to the fans.
Mm-hmm. So moving on from here, I don't want to skip the, we talked about them getting on the plane, that scene between Kate and Bonnie now on the tarmac at the airport, where Kate talks about a previous invasion by the Zygons, which would be from the old series, in the 70s or 80s, which is apparently a reference to a dating issue, imprecise dating of things in the older series, and how the Doctor stole a nerve gas that had been created specifically to fight the Zygons.
Right. So the dating thing is because when they established during the third Doctor's time, John Pertwee, he got locked on Earth. He couldn't travel off planet. And that's when he first began to team up with UNIT in a major way. And at the time, they wanted the UNIT stories to seem a little bit futuristic. And so even though they were in the 70s, they pretended that these stories were set in the 80s. But the writers didn't maintain the illusion. And so indications kept slipping through that this is really the 70s. And that led to a lot of fan speculation about how to resolve that dilemma. And they finally addressed it on screen in The Day of the Doctor, where Kate Lethbridge-Stewart tells Osgood to go look up a particular file and says it'll either be listed under the 70s or the 80s, depending on the dating convention. And so this is a callback to that. Yeah. The story for the previous Zygon invasion is called Terror of the Zygons, and it was set in Scotland, interestingly enough, with the Doctor wearing like a Scottish tam-o'-shanter and a tartan scarf. We also got to see Lethbridge-Stewart, Kate's father, wearing a kilt. And it was an interesting episode at the time. The Doctor's companions were Sarah Jane Smith, one of the most popular companions of all time, and Harry Sullivan, a naval surgeon who is the one that, even though it didn't happen on screen, he's the one that invented the Zygon gas that they're referring to. So they're referring to one of the Doctor's previous on-screen companions as the inventor of that.
Right.
Very good. And so from this point, Clara, or Bonnie, has now been tasked with the defense of the UK against the Zygons and says to Jack, is it Jack or Jace? I forget how they pronounced it on air.
Jack, I believe.
Jack.
I thought it was for Jacqueline or something.
Probably. She wants to swing by home, which is a very obvious sort of line for something's. I'm trying to maneuver you to get back to that apartment building, where they encounter this couple whose son this couple who are Zygon duplicates that we know are carrying a body into an elevator. They trace the elevator down into the tunnels beneath London, which apparently are all over the place because we are constantly seeing them on Doctor Who, where they find a bunch of Zygon pods. This is apparently a ploy. This is, of course, Bonnie is trying to use it as bait for UNIT, and professes surprise, and we have to come back here and wipe out these pods. Is this at the? Now I'm trying to remember. My notes don't say. Is this where they find out that Clara is down there, or yes. That's at this point not when they bring back the other soldiers. I think it's when they bring back the other soldiers. I'm trying to keep the sequence in mind.
Well, that's when it's revealed that it's actually a trap. It's a trap.
It's a trap. Admiral Akbar comes out.
And we're intercutting between there and Truth or Consequences, where Kate is now encountering an American sheriff who turns out to be a Zygon herself.
Right, and tries to, as we know later, tries to kill and replace Kate. So maybe we should just kind of sum it up, because there's a lot of intercutting at this point between those two and then the Termezistan, where the doctor arrives just as a drone strike is about to take place, and the drone operator, who a lot of the unit soldiers apparently are American. I don't know if you picked up on that. There are a lot of American accents. The drone operator is about to hit and sees these two people walk out, and they are apparently her family or Zygon duplicates, and she just can't bear to pull the trigger, even though intellectually she knows that they must be Zygons.
Really like that, because it's confronting us with the fact that it's easy to kill people you don't see if it's just numbers, if it's just... And we get a lot of news from... you know, faraway countries where, and you hear about a drone strike and et cetera, but it doesn't really hit home because, well, you haven't looked people in the face, and it becomes a totally different matter if you see children. And even if, you know, intellectually indeed, you know, well, that they are the enemy, it's still almost impossible for us to pull the trigger on people that look like us.
Well, when you unintentionally use the phrase here, it hits home.
Yeah.
For this drone operator, it literally would be like hitting home because they're not just faceless enemies. They are the faces that she knows, and that it's that connection that we need to make.
And that makes it so creepy, because it's this whole balance of, you know, when do you use force and when do you... It is just trying to negotiate. Is that a safe way to go? And the doctor seems to imply it's the only way to go. Otherwise, you'll get trapped in this vortex of hatred and revenge. And that seems to be the problem of our world right now. Mm-hmm. So I think that this episode reflects a number of really, really important themes right now in our society, and that's what I liked about it. It's kind of heavy-handed, though. I mean, it's really, like, I was looking for some levity, and, well, couldn't find it in this episode.
Not in this one. The second one got a little more.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jimmy.
I thought, and one of the things I really liked about this episode is the fact it was so intense. There have been a lot of episodes in the last season or two where I just had trouble taking it seriously. The suspense didn't seem real. It didn't seem effective. But in this one, it really did. It's like, this is a Doctor Who thriller. Mm-hmm. And I like the thriller genre. I liked the way they kept us guessing at points. I mentioned the one where already they had what looked like a setup for the doctor being a buffoon with two ordinary girls, but then it turns out he's totally right. And they did something similar with the when they replayed the same theme of the drone operator being unable to fire on her own family. They replayed that more dramatically with the scene on the church steps, where you have the unit soldier and apparently his mother come out and talk to him. And just going through that conversation and feeling the rhythms dramatically of that conversation, they kept alternating it. It's like, okay, he is going to kill her. No, maybe he's not going to kill her. No, maybe he is going to kill her.
Yes.
And they really played with that nicely. There were just moments where, you know, the woman has this horrible, and she's acting it very well, and she just very vulnerably says, "You're going to kill me, aren't you?" And you think, okay, she's doomed. She's just said what's about to happen. And then, "I forgive you." And it's like, okay, maybe he's not going to kill her. And I love the way they played that out. I thought that was a very effective scene.
Even though when they walk in, at least I was like yelling at my TV, like, "Dude, you're going to get killed." And yeah, of course, it happens. But I mean, could you kill an alien that looks like your mom? I couldn't do it. Never, ever. Yeah. So you know what? It was so there was so much tension at times that I was actually very relieved with that big question mark, the literal question mark. So the doctor still wears question marks.
Yeah, and actually, that's, believe it or not, that's actually a callback as well.
Really? Because
of the Doctor Who, yeah, if you go to, if you look up this episode on the TARDIS data core, they even have a, it's tardis.wikia.com, they have a picture from one of the Doctor Who comics of, I think it's the Eighth Doctor, if I remember correctly, where he's like, I don't know, materializing or something, and we see his question mark underpants.
Oh my gosh.
So that's actually a reference to the Doctor
Who
comic.
That is brilliant. At first, I didn't understand when they were going to the hatchery or where the pods were, which definitely had lots of kind of like alien and aliens type of visuals. There's this discussion between Kate. No, it's not Kate, the other woman that works for
Jack.
With Clara. And Clara is like, all middle-aged people think that the world is coming to an end. And it's only later on that you realize that she was trying to reassure her to make sure that the trap still works, you know. They still go
And of course, Bonnie is one of those young Zygons who's not middle-aged.
Yeah, true. Yes.
You know? So it's sort of one of those clues that of what's happening.
Yeah. Why Bonnie, by the way? Is there meaning to that? Why the name change?
I never got a sense of.
I didn't either. I noticed the doctor, or you noticed the doctor a couple of times at least, calls her Zygella.
Yeah.
And I wondered, what's that? Did they establish that as her name?
It's
and
apparently
I looked that up, and apparently it's a reference to a British celebrity named Nigella. Mm-hmm. So apparently that was a joke rather than being serious. But I don't know where Bonnie came from.
Nigella apparently is a feared TV cook. So, whatever. Some kind of...
Nigella Lawson, yeah.
Yeah.
So here's we come to the scene on the plane with Osgood and the Doctor, mm-hmm. where it's something very important. I want to kind of bring this out a bit because it has a bearing on the whole season, where he has this conversation about, are you the real Osgood or the Zygon Osgood? And he does this several times, through the two episodes. And she keeps saying, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I'm just Osgood. And he kind of says, you're a hybrid, and gets this funny look on his face. Now, hybrids have come up several times in this season. Mm-hmm. We had the hybrid Dalek, Time Lord DNA. We had the hybrid of a Shilder, who's a hybrid of human and Meyer DNA. And in a way, you could almost say that the ghosts in Under the Water were sort of a hybrid human alien construct of some sort, but it wasn't brought out as much as when it came up in those other two. The Doctor, both times with the Daleks and with the Shilder, kind of was taken aback and said, "Hybrid, what do you think is going on? What is your sense, Father? I'll ask you first. What is your sense of, is this, are we building up to the season long mythology that's only going to come out at the end of the season?"
Yeah, I think so. There's definitely, it's a recurring theme, but I'm very puzzled by it. I don't have a clue where this is leading. It's kind of almost at the fringe of my perception. It's like, now that you mention it, I'm thinking, yeah, he did say that. And I do remember that we've talked about this, but I don't see a clear, they're not giving it away. It's not like, but we're going to discover that the Doctor is a hybrid or whatever. The only thing that came to mind was that perhaps one of the messages they want to convey is that ultimately we are all kind of hybrids. We're never just, like, we don't have one nationality or one identity, but we're always a mix of the people that preceded us. And so perhaps that's why we should understand each other, world peace, blah, blah, blah. But perhaps I'm just a little bit too quick with that.
What do you think, Jimmy?
I don't know. It's something that, it could be setting us up for something significant. Obviously, Stephen Moffat has done series-long arcs before, but they've tended to be more obvious. Like the original season he did had the cracks in time as the season-long arc, and then we had the Wedding of River Song as the season-long arc, and we knew that we were building up to that. In this, they mentioned hybrids a few times, but it's not clear what it might be building up to, or even that it's building up to. So I wonder if it's just a leitmotif that that they're playing with, but that isn't really going to be paid off. I can't think of specific examples, but my memory is tingling with the idea that in previous seasons we've seen similar things where they kind of played with something but never really had a big payoff for it.
Hmm. It kind of feels to me like in the first season of the new series of The Bad Wolf. It wasn't big.
Yeah.
It showed up in the background. It was kind of here and there. Now I'm especially attuned to seeing anything hybrid. If he drives a Prius down the street, I'm going to be wondering, you know, about it. Was that van a hybrid vehicle? So we'll see how that turns out. So you know, we should all keep our eyes out for anything hybrid in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I just Googled it. And there's an article on radiotimes.com that's exactly poses this question. What is the hybrid? We analyzed the Series 9's biggest mystery. And so there are some theories as to who is the hybrid. Apparently there is a old Time Lord prophecy, which apparently the Doctor will have a hand in creating. And it has to do with the big question, like, who is the hybrid? And then there are some possibilities. It could be Clara, could be a Shielder, could be the Dalek, or the Daleks, could be the Doctor himself. I don't know. And then they have...
Actually, in the time of the Eighth Doctor, there was an indication that the Doctor was a hybrid, specifically a human Time Lord hybrid. Mm-hmm. In the 1996 Doctor Who TV movie, he claims to his... one-off assistant Grace that he's human on his mother's side.
Oh,
and,
Spock.
That has been largely ignored subsequently. But in view of the fact that River Song is a human Time Lord hybrid, that could add additional possibility there to the Doctor being a human Time Lord hybrid. Also, we've got River Song coming back in the Christmas special, so maybe she's the hybrid.
Hmm. Mm. The article also suggests that it could just be the new ride of the Doctor, and he's driving a hybrid. Whatever.
I've always suspected the TARDIS is a blend of more than one technology.
Yes. Oh, the TARDIS acronym. We have to remember to talk about that.
Yes, at the end. So let's wrap up this first episode. There's a lot of action where we have Osgood explains that Bonnie is keeping Clara alive to get information out of her. So we know that Clara's alive. In the Zygon cavern, Bonnie reveals that the whole thing has been a ambush, and they kill all of the unit soldiers. And meanwhile, in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, Kate appears to be killed by the Zygon sheriff. And then finally, at the end, Bonnie, with a handheld missile, shoots it from a surface-to-air missile at this presidential aircraft, which apparently has no countermeasures on it. Okay, I'm sorry. That's just my Tom Clancy nerd aspect getting a little annoyed. But fires a missile at the presidential aircraft just as it's arriving back in Britain, and that's where we leave that first episode. So, anyone want to kind of impressions of that first one?
Two quick thoughts. I like the episode overall. Like I've said, it was kind of in the thriller genre, and I appreciate that. One thing that I didn't like at the very end was just a small bit in the writing where Bonnie claims that Clara is dead. Well, they've just established Clara is alive.
Yeah.
And so why are we pointlessly... I mean, I understand... They don't even explain that in the second half of the episode, in the Zygon inversion. They just blow past it. Clara's alive again. There's no explanation of why Bonnie lied, apparently just to be cruel to the Doctor right before killing him. But it just struck me as more... needless hyping of the drama. It's like in the first episode of this season where the Doctor suddenly has to go to his death for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
Death drama is something that should be the spice and not the meat, and the more often you use it, the more it cheapens it. So I didn't like a gratuitous death threat. The And now I forget my second point, but it'll probably come back to me.
The destruction of the airplane seemed a little bit too much like, oh, the classic cliffhanger. And of course, the Doctor is going to survive. You know, they've done it too often. And you're like, yeah, yeah. She's going to miss or whatever. They don't even show the airplane exploding. So I'm thinking that he's going to be okay.
This is apparently the second presidential aircraft that the Doctor's been on when it's been blown out of the sky, as we saw in Death in Heaven last season. So I don't know whether they're going to make any more for the Doctor to go pouncing around again, if he's going to keep getting them shot out from under him.
Yes.
So
hey, in the meantime, between these two episodes, I've got a tip that I found on the website of the BBC. It's kind of on and off with their website in terms of what they give for, as background information. Sometimes it's a lot of behind the scenes stuff, and sometimes it's more like an analysis of all the references. And I think it depends on whether they have an intern that has time to write something. For this episode, they had a nice list of things to do in case of a Zygon invasion. And of course, the big question that we all ask ourselves, since one third of humanity is apparently Zygon, how do you know? So here's one question that you have to ask, and this is a suggestion by the BBC, so it's official. We suggest asking a question that only they would know the answer to, like such as, what's my favorite episode of Doctor Who? If they reply, the trouble with Tribbles, run for your life. I love it when they do stuff like that.
That's funny.
All right, that's just an interlude.
a nice little laugh. So now we move on to a whole week goes by.
I remember my other comment on this episode.
Good.
It passes the Bechdel test. For those who may not be aware, the Bechdel test is a test that's been applied to television shows and movies to see how realistically or they treat women. The test is there during the, or I may get this slightly wrong, but basically the test is there a conversation between two women in the movie or episode, and do they talk about something other than a man?
Yeah.
And so the Bechdel test shows a multiplicity of female characters who are able to have lives revolving around something other than exclusively men. And this episode is more Bechdel successive than anything else we've seen in a while. The Doctor is the only male major character in the episode. Every other major character is female. You've got Kate Lethbridge-Stewart, you've got Jack, her new assistant, you've got the Osgoods, you've got Clara, and they're all talking about stuff other than men. They're talking about previous Zygon invasions, and we've also got the New Mexico sheriff. Mm-hmm. And so you have a lot of scenes happening where women are talking to each other about stuff other than the Doctor and is he romantic or not.
However, Jimmy, half of those women are Zygons. So does that count?
But they're lady Zygons.
That's true. At least they're not discussing Zygon fashion or Zygon mascara.
Well, the great thing is I didn't even notice, which is the ideal situation.
Good, good, good.
Okay, so we begin the Zygon inversion with Clara in a dream state. We know it's a dream state because things are reversed, and we have a skewed perspective, as we were talking about before, a Hitchcockian perspective.
Black and, toothpaste. Ew.
Black toothpaste.
The pearly whites. And so she sees what Bonnie sees by turning on her television, just like we see what Bonnie sees by turning on our televisions to watch Doctor Who. Yes, and she's apparently able to. I didn't understand how she understood she could affect what Bonnie can do. Somehow she knew that she, by whacking the TV, she could cause Bonnie to miss with the missile. Any perspective on that?
I think she may have just been desperately trying to do something to affect things. She didn't necessarily know she could until she tried it and it worked.
It's like when I hit my television when the Patriots missed the catch.
I don't.
Does that work?
It never worked for me. I wish it did. I could control Tom Brady.
It's the old thing that you used to do with the, gosh, what's the word? The game where you have to push the sides of a...
Oh, pinball.
Pinball. Yeah, the pinball machine, and you try to shake it, so the you odds turn English into your favorite.
Well, or you're playing a flying game with your PlayStation, and you're leaning to the side.
Oh, yeah. You know,
okay, so that explains it. So it's just able to kind of accidentally,
more or less,
yeah.
I mean,
one. Oh, go.
No, go ahead. I was a bit disappointed that the second time when she was biting her index finger that it wasn't enough apparently. So the airplane does get shot out of the air, which was kind of
Well, it maintains drama because if she could just totally control Bonnie from that point on, it would have sucked drama out of the episode. I like the fact it sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. Mm-hmm. That helps sustain the dramatic tension. And that's what I was going to say. I really liked the dramatic tension in this very Hitchcockian Twilight Zone-like dream sequence of Clara's. I thought it was very effectively done. One thing I had a little bit of a quibble, and this is just because I'm in the publishing industry, but when Clara picks up the newspaper in the dream and is flipping through it, and most of it is filled with garbage. You know, it's just random letters. It popped me out of the story for a second because it should have been lorem ipsum.
Yes.
And if you're in the publishing industry, you know what that is. Lorem ipsum is a bunch of fake Latin text that's used as placeholder text whenever you've got a layout, but you don't have the actual text to go in it yet. And so that would have just been the perfect thing to have a newspaper filled with lorem ipsum.
But this was just a Zygon equivalent. This is the text that they always use on their planet. I was struck by the fact that at one point she discovers that she's in a dream or in a, you know, closed in, and she opens that window and there's a wall, and it made me think back of the first Matrix movie where that happens when they are, you know, the bad guys are in pursuit and they modify basically the reality or projected reality, and they try to open a door and there's a wall and they open a window, and this was very much the same thing. And so it looked like almost like a visual homage as well.
And do we think that the dream state is something that the Zygons intentionally impose, or is it something that Clara did herself? It's sort of an interesting question for me, because it seems to me, I feel like Clara is becoming more and more into her own with some sort of power, Time Lord-ish power. I don't want to get too far down that road, but something seems to be different about Clara this season, and I'm trying to put my finger on it.
Well,
and there's
the Doctor at one point says something about the mind of Clara and how special it is, and so it seemed to me that this must be a particular talent of Clara to be inside her own mind and to uphold a certain sense of identity, even though she is supposed to be in whatever hypersleep or something.
It could be that the Zygons, they need the people who are in their pods to not be conscious, and you know, otherwise they'd climb out of the pods or try to. And so it could be that they just artificially put people to sleep, and dreams are a natural consequence of that. Mm-hmm. But there is the phenomenon of lucid dreaming, where you become aware of the fact that you're dreaming and even can have sensory input from outside influence the dream. In fact, I had that happen to me last night.
Really?
I was listening to an audiobook, and elements of the audiobook showed up in my dream. So it's not necessarily that Clara is different. It just may be one of those things, or maybe she is different. Maybe she has acquired some additional abilities, or maybe it's just a plot convenience.
Mm-hmm.
It always possible with Stephen Moffat. So Bonnie now stalks an average Zygon. Apparently, her goal now is the next stage is to start exposing Zygons to get the human population afraid. Mm-hmm. There's this interesting scene where she's kind of walking him toward his apartment. Did you notice that the location is the same location mm-hmm. from Flatline where the graffiti was on the wall? Jimmy, you look like you noticed that.
Yeah, that struck me. It looks a lot like it's also Clara's apartment building, isn't it?
I don't think it was, but it's possible, I guess.
I might have that wrong, but I thought it was. I thought it was interesting that it's not clear to us initially why Bonnie is doing this to this person. Mm-hmm. Because he runs over to these other people that are sitting around, and they basically don't react to him. And so we're led to think this guy is a human, and the other people who don't react are Zygons. And so it looks at first like she's turning him into a Zygon for whatever, you know, purposes of her agenda that would be required for. She's making him a hybrid human Zygon, and really we find out later, no, he always was a Zygon. She's just forcing him back into his true form.
Mm-hmm. So that she can post a YouTube video of him to stoke the fears of the populace.
Yeah. It was a little bit underdeveloped as a plot. I mean, they could have not done that, and I wouldn't have missed it.
Right. So now we have the Doctor and Osgood. Clara sees that they've escaped from the plane. She sees the little blue dot mm-hmm. on her TV screen. They parachuted from the plane at the very last moment. Apparently, no one else from the plane escaped, which is sad, but unremarked. And the Doctor has his Union Jack parachute.
Like James Bond.
Yes.
Exactly.
It's all disguise. It's camouflage. Camouflage.
They banter over the sonic sunglasses, and Osgood is with a lot of us fans. She doesn't get it. She doesn't. She doesn't like his sonic sunglasses.
Yeah.
I like how they put that in because all these episodes were written before any of them were shown, and so we have the writers anticipating fan reaction and giving the fans a voice before the episodes are even filmed, much less broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
Osgood, like the soldier in Under the Water. Who eventually dies is a fan of the Doctor, just like we are. She's that stand-in for us. She's a cipher for the fans, which is one of the reasons why fans like her, like Osgood, so much.
Yeah.
I like that he tells her not to look at his browser history, and then she says, "Whoa!"
Yes, I told you.
Clara lets the Doctor know that she's still alive by subliminally sending a text message through Bonnie.
Mm-hmm.
That's some talent, being able to text on an iPhone without looking.
I couldn't text on my iPhone without looking. That strained the bounds of credibility to me.
I've seen it done, so it is possible. So but it's not easy. Very interesting. They talk about texting. How much more human can you get? Says Osgood, which is a funny line. Back at Unit HQ. Clara comes in. The place is empty. She comes in. She goes to a wall safe. Now, two things. She walks by a mirror and sees Clara in her PJs.
Mm-hmm.
And then she goes to the wall safe, which is behind a portrait of someone we recognize. Jimmy?
The First Doctor.
I was wondering who that was. Cool. Nice.
Also, and we saw the same safe just very briefly in the same portrait very briefly in the first episode. It's in the safe house, or what they call the safe house. And I can't help wondering, given that there's a safe in the safe house, is that part of why it's called that?
It's all about the safe. I'm not going to sing the song. So this in the safe, she finds a laptop, which is bound for a bad fate, because Osgood was apparently tortured to reveal the location of the Osgood box, and she told him this safe. But it turns out, as she opens it, the video on the laptop says it's not really here. I lied to you.
And it also says there's a reason it's called the Osgood box. Can you guess what it is? And so that's a nice tease for what we're eventually going to find out.
Exactly. the Doctor in Osgood run into some police who are apparently Zygons. Were they Zygons, or were they just like the people that the Zygon was running away from in the previous scene, just humans who were, I don't know what to make of you.
I think all those humans, including the cops, were Zygons, and they just have this flatness of affect that is creepy.
Or it could be social commentary on the state of the police in the UK. It's like, you ask for help, and they just look at you like...
Well, they do later start pursuing the Doctor and Osgood, although in a kind of creepy, slow way.
Yes.
So the Doctor calls Bonnie on FaceTime, and... they have some banter about her plans. You're supposed to have a plan because you're on a planet. He calls himself Dr. Puntastic. And meanwhile, Clara is sending subliminal winks at the Doctor through Bonnie, which he replies, and this is the reference you made, Father, "You're sending me some mixed signals. You know I'm 2,000 years old. I'm old enough to be your messiah." a fun reference. And then,
If I had been there, I would have said, "But you're not."
Nice try, Doctor.
And then we get the Doctor driving through London. Meanwhile, Bonnie goes to poke around in Clara's memories. She stands outside the pod, and they have this very interesting scene, which I think is well acted by Jenna Coleman.
Both of her, exactly.
In fact, I think she does a great job in throughout this episode as both Bonnie and Clara. You know, but this whole thing about they can't lie to one another because their hearts are linked, which is a very interesting, I think, both literal and figurative reference. You know, their hearts are linked, and you cannot lie to me. And go ahead, Jimmy.
I had a couple of thoughts about that. The first one is, I mean, heartbeat lie detection is very inaccurate. If someone, there are lots of people who can control their heartbeat in a way that lets them pass polygraph tests. That's why polygraph tests, at least, I don't know how it is in the Netherlands, Father, but here in the United States, polygraph tests are not admissible in court because they're unreliable. And all you have to do, like if... the British spy, Kim Philby, was known to just take like a beta blocker or a Valium or something before he had to submit to his mandatory polygraph tests. He would just sail right through them. So polygraph tests are not that great, and especially a polygraph test just limited to your heartbeat. But having said that, my first thought, and I like the way they played the scene out, so I was happy with it in the end. But my first thought, if I was in Clara's situation, I would start jogging in my dream immediately, you know, to get my heartbeat up so that Bonnie can't use it as a reliable signal of what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
And so I was a little disappointed they didn't go that route.
That would have been good. I like the reference the Doctor talks about, you know, from one scene to London, what a great town, to London, what a dump. And then Osgood says, "You spend an awful lot of time here for a dump." So they show up where Clara sent them, which is to this mall where this one Zygon. We never actually do we get a name for him? I don't know if we actually get a name for him. Who Bonnie forcibly revealed, and he ends up. Yeah, the outed. That's a good way of putting it. Actually, I don't want to skip this. While they're going into the mall, the Doctor and Osgood have this back and forth about their first names. And he says, you know, again, this name game. He says Basil, but he gets a weird look on his face. Is there? Do you think there's a reason, or is it just Capaldi playing off the scene?
I did find something because, of course, the entire fan base is asking this question: so where does his name come from? And what I found was that there has been like a fictional, what was it, a comic book figure that was somehow related to some Doctor Who. It was a very vague story. I just didn't get it.
Interesting.
I don't know. Basil is a somewhat common British name. Oh, I bet I know what it is. It's okay. So the first thing that I thought of was Basil Fawlty, the John Cleese character. Oh. But I bet that's not it. Now that I think about it, it's Basil Brush. Basil Brush.
Yeah, that's what I read.
Is a Fox puppet character on British television that has had an association with Doctor Who. So I bet it could be Basil Brush.
That's what I read, but I didn't understand. I had never heard of that puppet. So I was like, what is the link to Doctor Who?
So in addition to the names, we get another conversation about whether the Osgood that's left is human or Zygon, and we're still left with without a resolution.
I think that's part of Stephen Moffat's philosophy of writing. And by the way, he's listed as co-author on this second of the two episodes, mm-hmm. which means he had a more significant hand than usual in writing it. Usually that signals a problem episode, but this one he did a good job. And one of his known pieces of writing philosophy is that oftentimes it's the question that's more interesting than the answer. And so he likes to leave things suspended without actually answering them. He did that in Sherlock when he brought Sherlock back from the dead, and he tossed mm-hmm. out some theories about how Sherlock could have survived, but he never definitively gave us an answer. Mm-hmm. He did that with the name of the doctor, where he built that up for a good chunk of a season, and then we have Clara explaining to the Time Lords that the only name that ever really matters is the Doctor. It doesn't matter what his real name is. And that is played with in this scene, alongside the fact that it's more interesting to wonder, is this the human or the Zygon Osgood, than it is to know the actual answer. And so he deliberately leaves that Schrodinger's cat box unopened because it's mm-hmm. more interesting not to open it.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we revisit this right at the end. It's sort of as the resolution, we get another element of that whole mystery. I like this encounter between the Doctor and this unmasked Zygon, who is hurting the Doctor. He's zapping the Doctor, and from the Doctor's point of view, there's no anger at this. There's no you're hurting me, and I'm going to hurt you back. It's this constant approaching, like, I want to help you. There's just no sense from the Doctor's point of view that he's angry at this Zygon. There's just mercy and forgiveness constantly being offered to the Zygon, who sadly finds no other solution than to commit suicide at the end of the scene.
I'm the Doctor and I save people. Little messianic subtext there.
Absolutely.
Yep. Okay, so we...
Before we move on from that, this guy actually commits suicide on screen in front of us. I mean, it's in a science fiction manner, but wow, on a family show, we just saw an on-screen suicide. Yeah. That's really pretty intense.
Yeah, I mean, is it more intense than an on-screen murder? I mean, it's... not that I'm discounting what you're saying, but it's kind of funny mm-hmm. how the sorts of things we tend to be squeamish about. You know, we see people get killed.
Killing another person is horrific, but killing oneself is even more unnatural than killing another person, because killing another person can be morally legitimate if it's in self-defense, mm-hmm. but killing yourself is intrinsically wrong, and mm-hmm. so it's creepier for that reason. It's less creepy because it's done in a science fiction manner. I mean, he zaps himself to death.
Yeah.
It's less creepy than if he had a gun and used that mm-hmm. or a knife and used it, right. But it's still pretty creepy.
For a family-oriented show, indeed.
Yeah. Yes. A pile of crackling Brillo.
Yeah, is that the hair that remains on the floor? I never got that. Is it?
It's like a staticky tumbleweed. I think it's just supposed to be sort of whatever remains of the human body when you've sucked it of whatever that zapping does to it mm-hmm. or something. I don't know. We're supposed to look too closely at that one. So Kate shows up, and we're supposed to think it's the Kate with the Zygon replacement Kate to send the doctor to
totally
the body.
Totally knew it wasn't.
And she says she disposed of the sheriff 5 rounds rapid, which is and not live rounds. I saw some references. It's actually 5 rounds rapid. That's a reference to the callback to the Brigadier, right, Jimmy?
Correct. In a previous episode, it's Doctor Who and the Daemons from the third Doctor's time. Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart orders one of his soldiers to shoot a gargoyle man with 5 rounds rapid.
Yeah. And apparently that has become kind of a fan favorite phrase, even though it was used only once. But it is, I think, even in the memoirs of the actor who played the guy. So it was again, fan service that they used that here.
That kind of fan service is okay.
Yeah, it's I've got it here. Though the line was used only once, it proved memorable among fans and even ended up becoming the title of actor Nicholas Courtney's first autobiography.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, cool.
So from there, we see that Bonnie discovers, she goes to the Black Archives and mm-hmm. discovers not only, oh. discovers, okay, Jimmy.
That reminds me. Okay, so the name of the Black Archive seems to be based on something that really exists. There is the Scotland Yard has a museum known as the Black Museum. And in the Black Museum, they have all this stuff that they got from historically significant crime cases, like murders. Like they'll have a pair of binoculars that have like a way to kill you if you look through them and stuff that people came up with in the past. And so the Black Archive is the unit equivalent of that, where you have all this stuff that aliens used in memorable adventures where they committed crimes. And so I was surprised to learn that the name the Black Archive, I thought it was just a cool name, but I was recently reading a book, I forget if it was a book on espionage or not, but I was recently reading a book and came across a reference to the Black Museum, and I realized that's where they got that.
Very interesting. Well, so Bonnie ends up down there, and she discovers why it's called an Osgood box, or Osgood boxes. There are two of them, red and blue.
And you don't know which is which.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the doctor tells her that one box normalizes all the Zygons and the other destroys them. And both boxes have buttons that say truth and consequences. So my question is, why did the doctor label them truth and consequences? Like, did he know something about the town of New Mexico? How did they come up with the manifesto, truth or consequences, and then the box would be labeled such? It's this sort of this weird synchronicity.
This popped me out of the story too, because it's like, okay, we've had the Zygons talking about truth or consequences up to this point. Why are the boxes labeled truth or consequences? On a story level, it's interesting. I mean, those two labels play nicely with the themes of, okay, this is going to reveal all the Zygons, that could be truth, mm-hmm. or it's going to kill all the Zygons, that could be consequences. So they resonate on the story level. If I had to give it a fan rationalization explanation, I would say my guess would be because this is not the first time this has happened, mm-hmm. and the doctor has had previous go-rounds, which he alludes to, and I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit more, and he, during those previous go-rounds, learned about Truth or Consequences, New Mexico.
Could be. Mm-hmm.
I think you're right. That would be the fan rationalization. I find it interesting. I think it's there for a reason. I'm just still working it out of my own mind a little bit.
By the way, there's another connection between the boxes and truth or consequences. In the original TV version of the game show, I believe there was also a radio version, but in the original TV version of the game show, it was hosted by Bob Barker, mm-hmm. and famous American game show host. And by the way, the doctor attempts not very successfully an American accent.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, is he trying to sound American?
It's about as good as my Scottish accent.
Yeah, and he also attempts, he talks like a game show host.
Yes.
And he's evoking, he's not necessarily imitating, but he's evoking Bob Barker from Truth or Consequences, because one of the elements of that game show was a segment called Barker's Box. And in Barker's Box, he had a box that they would spin around. It had four drawers, and you won or lost depending on which drawers you opened, and you didn't know which drawers to open.
That is cool.
And if you go on YouTube and type in Truth or Consequences game show, you'll find a clip. It's part three of three, where they actually play Barker's Box.
Nice. Wow, that is very, very deep geek territory. Awesome.
So let's dive into this final scene, because I really feel like everything this is the heart of these two episodes. This is this and I don't know your opinions. You can tell me your opinions now, but I think this is some of the best writing I've seen in the Moffat era of Doctor Who. It's right up there with what I consider one of the greatest hours of or greatest episodes of television, which is the wedding episode of Sherlock. I just find that whole episode to be some of the most perfect TV writing, and this is right up there with it. I love this scene. What did you think, Father?
Yeah, it was amazing. It's just one long monologue, and I didn't want it to stop. It was brilliant, and it was also very well acted, because with a lot of intensity and passion, and I mean, it felt to me like a homily. Like this is someone who's preaching, and he really wants to get the message across. And especially it started to really get, you know, hit me when he started to refer to basically his own war and his own role, and the lessons that he learned from, you know, the consequences of choosing the destruction. And that made it very personal all of a sudden, and you understand why he is so upset and so adamant to get this across. And I felt, you know, this goes beyond Doctor Who. This is a message for all of us, for our time, for the world in which we live. And so this whole, to me, this sermon kind of transcended the boundaries of the TV show. It's like, wow, this is something we should all hear. And the you know, break the cycle. And the one phrase that is so important is that he says the only way to break the cycle is when you start to forgive. That's the only way out. And it's like, that is amazing to hear that in a science fiction series like that. It was so true.
Jimmy, what did you think?
I thought that it was a good speech, and I think this is where Stephen Moffat made his major contribution to the episode. If I had to lay money, I would say this is just Moffat talking. And I thought it was a good speech. I don't know that I had quite the same. I don't know that it had quite the same wow factor for me, because I've seen so many variations on the "let's not kill each other" speech, you know, and throughout science fiction. It's kind of a regular trope. But I thought this was a good execution of it. I liked the tie-ins to the Doctor's own war. I really liked the line about forgiving. In today's victim culture, where you have, you know, every group, I mean, everybody in society is in danger of turning themselves, no matter who you are, no matter what your race, what your sex, what your sexual orientation, everybody is in danger of turning themselves into a victim group and trying to leverage that to get social advantage. And that turns society against itself and is ultimately destructive. Mm-hmm. And the only way to get out of that destructive cycle, like the Doctor says in this episode, is to forgive. And to not worry about all the slights, however real they may have been, not to worry about all the slights that have been committed against you. Because if you allow yourself to be trapped by what has been done to you, then you're trapped. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it was, even though it's kind of a standard trope, I thought it was a well-executed version of the trope, and I liked it.
What made me think this was a better than your average version of that trope was that the... it wasn't easy. I mean, too often, you know, it's like, oh, we've got 5 minutes. We're going to wrap up this episode of whatever show we're watching. And they'll, you know, the main character gives a speech and it changes hearts and everyone walks away better for it. And this, you could see, and this is where I think Jenna Coleman acts this so well. You could see the emotions play in her face and this back and forth where she wants to believe and then hardens her heart, and the Doctor emotes and at once disdainful, then passionate, and then forgiving, and it's this back and forth and this emotional tug of war, like great moments, like when he says to her, you know, she says, I can't be forgiven, and he says,
yeah, that was good.
He goes, you screaming kids, you think you're unforgivable, you I forgive you. After all you've done, I forgive you. And I'm thinking to myself, is Moffat been like watching Pope Francis's speeches? It's almost like he's channeling Pope Francis here. True. With mercy and yeah. forgiveness mm-hmm. and no, say no to war. And it was just, I thought it was really great.
You know, it just occurred to me what I think, as much as I liked Kate Lethbridge-Stewart in this scene and her willingness to use force to stand up for humanity, I thought that was appropriate. But what I think would have made this scene even better is if, because they have Clara right there on set with Bonnie, and Clara has nothing to do in this scene. Mm. She just stands there. And I think if they had found a way to knock Kate Lethbridge-Stewart unconscious and have Clara step up, because she'd previously been seen, you know, commanding unit soldiers, so she's clearly got some authority in unit if you know, Kate is out of action and Jack is now dead. So you could have had Clara step up and be the one to push the button or not over the other box, and you could have had the doctor adjudicating between Clara and Bonnie, and I think mm-hmm. that could have carried the scene to a higher level.
Ah, good point.
I suppose my counter argument is on that mm-hmm. one, because it's not a bad idea, but the idea they wanted to get across at the very end of this, the doctor said, the reason that you've changed is because Clara Oswald got in your head.
Yeah, mm-hmm. they did
once
do
she's
that.
In
yeah.
there. You know, she changes you. You know, you know, like it. She changed him, which we have seen. Mm-hmm. I mean, the doctor we have today is very different from the doctor who emerged from regeneration, mm-hmm. and you know, and referred to her as his carer, the person who cares on his behalf, back in the inside the Dalek.
You know what they could have done that I like your objection, and I think there's a way to work to use it actually in my alternative scenario for this scene, because previously it was Clara who kept the doctor from pushing the button on Gallifrey in the Day of the Doctor, and here we have these Osgood boxes that look exactly like the moment.
Yes.
And now it could be the doctor's turn to keep Clara from pushing the button mm-hmm. and remind her of the role she played for him, and yeah. so I think there would be a way to incorporate that.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
That would be good. That was good. Gosh, there was so much more in this. So many good lines. He says, you know, Bonnie says, we treat it like cattle. You just want cruelty to beget cruelty. You know, you're not superior to people who were cruel to you. You're just a bunch of new cruel people. A bunch of new cruel people being cruel to some other people who will end up being cruel to you. And it's like, yes, this is the cycle. This is human history. You know, where instead of forgiving, break the cycle, we just we are justified in being cruel to you because you were cruel to us, and we're gonna bunk you in the head because you bunked me in the head, and like little squabbling children.
Mm-hmm.
It in one sense, I feel like Moffat. I wouldn't ever say this, but I feel like Moffat, with his previous line about the doctor, I'm old enough to be your messiah, you know, the doctor is coming in here in a Christ-like role, bringing peace, the priest, peace bringer. I mean, throughout this whole thing, he's all, this is the, to kind of step back and take a 10,000 foot view of this, this is one of the things I love about Doctor Who that makes it different from all other science fiction, which is that the Doctor is about peace. I'm okay with Star Trek and the Enterprise being armed and defending itself, and Star Wars being about scrappy rebels. But I like that there is a science fiction series which is about the main character who's about peace, first and foremost, who is not a peacenik who's never experienced war or even done anything bad. I mean, that's one of the things he says to Bonnie here. He's done horrible things. Like, you call this a war? This is nothing compared to what I've done. And even to the where he says, he hears the screams of children in his mind, and he wants peace so that you don't have to experience that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really love that there's this series is here to be that for us.
And right in time for the Year of Mercy that starts in a couple of weeks from now.
Exactly.
One of the things I really liked in his speech is where he forces Bonnie to imagine what happens if you win. Because oftentimes revolutionaries or people who have nostalgia for the way things were and wish society would change in a particular direction, they have a very idealistic view of, and then everything will be perfect. But right. will it really? Won't there mm-hmm. just be a new set of problems you have to deal with? And I like the way he forces her down that path mentally to think through, is utopia, is perfection really achievable in this life? And you know in your heart, no, it's not. And my dreams of a glorious revolution really are not going to produce the perfect society. Everything will not be perfect. Yeah. And it may even contain the seeds of its own undoing. Trying to obtain a perfect society may actually harm society and make it worse.
Mm. It, to cross the streams for a second, on December 18th, I think we'll see J.J. Abrams' vision of that sort of the revolution does not beget the perfect society that was hoped for. Mm-hmm. But let's not go down. We're already at 90 minutes. So let's not go down that path. I want to wrap up this amazing scene. Anything else? I mean, there's a lot more. I'm actually thinking of writing a blog post to kind of fully give sure. My thoughts on this, because there's so much more than that could be said in this episode. But anything else?
Well, there was a little gotcha, which was the catchphrase of the 11th Doctor and Amy Pond. So he used to say that a lot. Some people think it could also be a reference to a BBC One show called Noel's House Party, where they did the gotcha Oscars. this is a way to prevent being sued by the Oscar Society. And they awarded this year an Oscar to the Third Doctor, John Pertwee. But seems to me almost like a coincidental.
Sure.
I like that that we discovered that he had already, you know, wiped their memories. I don't know how many times, so that it wasn't like he didn't win the argument right from the get go. It took him a while to convince everyone. I like that. That leaves us just with the acronym of the TARDIS.
Yes, which Osgood, for all her fandom, apparently doesn't know, but not necessarily because it's not a real fan, but maybe she's too much of a fan. Jimmy, there was some dispute over time of what TARDIS really stands for.
Indeed, I think that
Jimmy's frozen.
Jimmy's frozen in time. I'll channel Jimmy here for a second. So according to this doctor, it means totally and radically driving in space, which is the lamest explanation of the acronym. According to it could stand for time and relative dimension in space. This was stated by Susan in the first episode, and also used in subsequent episodes. But then Vicky in the Time Meddler in the 60s said that the acronym stood for Time and Relative Dimensions in Space. It's just plural. And that's all I could find about the acronym.
Yeah. So I knew that there was some question of what it exactly stood for, but I like his cheesy explanation.
Yes.
That goes along with this doctor's snarkiness.
It feels like totally fitting for the doctor to come up with something that is so lame that everybody thinks it's fake, but it's the real one.
So the doctor offers to take Osgood as a companion. That's that would have been something. I think a lot of fans would like to see that.
Yeah.
But Osgood says, no, I've got something to do, and I've got someone to do it with.
Mm-hmm.
Bonnie fully embraces the new way, her new way of peace, and becomes the other Osgood and the embodiment of the peace treaty again.
Yeah.
Now, there's something at the very end when the doctor and Clara, unless you have something to say on that, Father.
But, no. Go ahead.
They're in the TARDIS at the very end, and Clara says, you must have thought I was dead for a while. How was that? And he said, the longest month of my life. And she says, it could only have been 5 minutes. He says, I'll be the judge of time.
Yeah.
But he gets this queer look in his face. And mm-hmm. again, I don't want to read too much of it, but I feel like something's going on that we're going to find out something about by the end of Clara's time with the doctor. I told my wife, I'm going to go out public with this. Mm-hmm. I think Clara's already dead.
What?
And that this is some sort of echo of Clara or something. Some sort of sci-fi Clara resonance.
Ooh, okay. That's a surprise.
based on nothing but instinct. I'm not spoiling anything because I don't know anything.
Oh, you'd
but
better not be right, because otherwise I'm going to be very, very mad at you.
Well, I'm gonna just put it out there, and you can tell me how
you
wrong
just
it
played
was,
so. The I see dead people ninth sense card here.
That's right.
She's been dead all along.
So, and that's it for this episode. Coming up, we have two more that are related. Is that right?
Yes. And then
the next episode is called Sleep No More.
Yeah.
Which is a found footage episode.
Cool.
A la the Cloverfield experiment, mm-hmm. and the Blair Witch Project. And then there's the one after that is called Face the Raven. Now, I wasn't. When I read the summaries that are available online, they seem very different.
Okay.
But apparently they are connected, so I'm not sure what the connection is. So we'll have to see what that ends up being.
Yeah.
That's it. We had a marathon session there.
As always. Well, it's just time, you know. It's a commodity.
It could have been 5 minutes. It could have been a month.
There are some time lords who apparently listen to podcasts at 1.25 speed. So you'll be the master of time.
I am the master of time. Well, I got to say, it sounds listening to everyone talk when I'm not listening to the recording, it sounds very slow. So
hey, laser brain, we're not all as fast as you are. Hey, Jimmy couldn't rejoin us for technical reasons, but you can find his website over at jimmyakin.com, and links to his social media profiles are also in the show notes that you can find over at sqpn.com/Doctor Who, thanks to our producer, Inga Lotz. And you are also on the web. You talked about your blog. Where can people find that?
Yes, people can find me at betnet.com, BETTNET.com. And I'm doing more blogging there these days. So
yeah, I noticed.
Come and find me, and all my links to my social media from there.
Very cool. And I'm active on sqpn.com, and I have a new YouTube channel as well. So if you want to see a priest completely geeking out about anything Star Wars or lots of other geeky stuff, then you might want to go to the show notes as well and click on that link and subscribe to the YouTube channel. And there's more to come because, of course, Star Wars. Need I say more? By the way, we used to do a show, The Secrets of Star Wars, but we stopped because we were afraid that we would spoil the movie because of the rumors and what we could talk about and not. But don't you think it's time for us to do at least another episode before we go watch the movie?
I think we should probably talk about, maybe we could talk about the trailers that we've seen.
Yeah.
And maybe what we're, you know, just the anticipation of, you know, the first showing. I have a ticket already for December 17th, 7 p.m. Eastern
Whoa,
time.
That late. I'll be seeing that movie on December the 15th.
Ugh.
I'm going to the premiere.
how much is a plane ticket to the Netherlands, and will my wife be okay with that?
Probably not. Actually, this is revenge because for the premiere of The Phantom Menace, I had to fly to the United States because we got the movie like half a year later.
That's true.
So I flew for Jar Jar Binks all the way to Texas, just so you know.
Oh, that's – yeah, that wasn't – yeah, not an advantage flying to Texas to see Jar Jar. No, but I think you're right. We do need to – do another episode of Secrets of Star Wars to get ramped up. And then afterward, once we've seen it –
oh, boy. Then we
six
can,
or seven times the first
no
weekend.
No more secrets.
That's right.
I'm looking forward to it. All that can be found on the website of sqpn.com.
All right. Well, thank you for everyone for joining us. Thank you, Father Roderick. Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you to our regular panel, Father Koistika and Stephanie Zimmer, who couldn't join us this time. Until next time, what is our catchphrase?
I don't know. Do we have a catchphrase?
Which, until next time, shush, as the doctor says.
Gotcha.
When will I see you again?
Soon, I expect. Or later. One of those.